Good evening, friends. Welcome to Valley Writers Read. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, excited to tell you that we've got a very original and somewhat unusual show for you tonight. It's all about the Hmong community in and around Central California. The author is the renowned photographer and filmmaker Joel Pickford, and the stories he is going to read are from his recently published and absolutely stunning book called Soul Calling. Here he is, Joel Pickford, reading excerpts from Soul Calling.
Sooner or later, every photographer finds his or her muse in a particular place. For Edward Weston, it was the fog-shrouded cliffs of Point Lobos. For Diane Arbus, it was the social melting pot of Central Park. In the spring of 2005, I would find my photographic muse in a cockroach-infested apartment complex next to a ditch bank in central Fresno. My first look at the place is through the bug-smeared windshield of a social service organization's van. This is a village teeming with life. Hmong families of 15 and 20 spill out of tired doorways. Vegetable gardens sprout from every available patch of dirt. Kids play soccer on the grimy patio surrounding a kidney-shaped pool now filled in with cement. Old women slit the throats of chickens and pluck their feathers. Laundry dries on sawed-off stumps of dead trees. Three men squat together in one corner, smoking a mixture of tobacco and opium from a large bong made of black PVC pipe. A young woman with Down syndrome comes up to the van to greet our driver. I now sorely regret the decision not to bring my camera on this first visit. These are the new arrivals. A petite Lao woman with a long name, Chantanom Tutu Lunbandint Butapanya, drives a big gray passenger van through some of Fresno's poorest neighborhoods, picking up and dropping off Hmong refugees for English classes, employment counseling, and other services. I have asked to ride along in order to get a feel for the lay of the land where I will be working for the next 5 years. I quickly discover that Dudu is much more than a transportation coordinator, her euphemistic job title. She has an amazing rapport with the refugees, greeting each one by name as he or she climbs into the van, and asking for the latest news of their families. She keeps up a lively banter with them in Thai, the lingua franca of Southeast Asian refugees. As we drive past rows of faded stucco apartment buildings and run-down tract houses, Tutu points out the homes of Hmong families she thinks I might be interested in photographing. "That family over there have 13 kids. The one across the street just lost their son in a shooting. Tomorrow they're gonna do a ceremony and kill a cow." Tutu is a Laotian refugee from the southern province of Savannakhet. Her maternal grandfather, a prosperous businessman, told her mother never to marry a soldier, which she did in spite of the warning. After the war, Tutu's family was arrested and sent to a series of forced labor camps in Laos and Vietnam, where they spent 10 years. One night, without saying a word to anyone, Tutu's father escaped from the camp and disappeared into the jungle. A week later, her mother followed suit, leaving 15-year-old Tutu and her 13-year-old brother despondent. Tutu noticed that some of the guards went home at night, while those who stayed often slept on the job. After making their own nocturnal escape, she and her brother embarked on a nightmarish 6-month journey, finally reuniting with their parents at Nong Seng refugee camp in Thailand. My day-long tour of the Fresno Hmong world is nearly complete. We have seen all of the big central and southeast apartment complexes, Sin City, South Clovis, and a few Hmong farms near Highway 99 and Jensen. I keep thinking about that apartment complex by the canal. I can't wait to return with my camera. But the biggest discovery of the day is Tutu. She will be indispensable to the project. As the gray January day dims to dusk, it starts to drizzle on our windshield. I glance down and notice for the first time that Tutu is driving barefoot. Seeing. The Zhang family has 9 children, 3 of whom are blind. We meet them after their first week in Fresno. They are all huddled together on 2 couches, sharing blankets and sick with a feverish flu. In addition to his blindness, the oldest teenage boy's face is a mass of scar tissue resulting from exposure to chemical weapons. Some spots are bleeding and bandaged. He is flanked by 2 sisters. The younger one looks frightened and trembles with fever. The older one is maturing into a beautiful young woman in spite of her circumstances. A younger blind boy with large blue cataracts is squeezed against the armrest to her left. On the bigger couch, the mother cradles an infant surrounded by 5 young children. The smallest blind boy dozes at her feet. His skin shows yellowish signs of jaundice. 3 social workers have come along with Tutu and me to assess the needs of this family, which seem overwhelming. The social workers sit stiffly on folded chairs, squarely facing the family on their end-to-end couches. Tutu and I sit on the floor. I scoot closer to one of the couches and measure the light through my camera. Despite the dark winter day, a sliding glass door to one side provides beautiful, if weak, portrait lighting on the faces of the children. Using a tripod from my low position on the floor, I make a few test exposures to see how the kids will react to the camera. They are amazingly tolerant of it. I move in closer, shooting pictures of the mother and children on the left-hand sofa. But my real goal is to photograph Zhang, the 10-year-old blind boy on the other couch. Unlike his blind older brother, disfigured by chemical exposure, Zhang's face is powerfully expressive. Flame blue cataracts set against his mahogany skin give his eyes an eerie, far-off light, as though he sees things the rest of us cannot. Earlier, as the interview began, I studied the boy's movements carefully. He seemed to react to things that were being said, shifting the angle of his head and the direction of his gaze. He seemed to respond to air currents and the movements of other people in the room. Maybe he could see the spirits. In almost every photographic situation, there is one overriding image that cries out to be captured. Sometimes it is a picture that perfectly sums up the place or story. Other times it is an anomalous subject that goes against the grain of everything around it. Sometimes it is just a picture you have to have and you don't know why. Most of the time, photographers fail to get this ultimate picture, but there is always the next shoot. From the moment I walked in that room, I knew that if I came away with no other image, I had to capture the strange light in that boy's eyes. I pick up my tripod and scoot along the floor to the other sofa, setting up in front of Zhang. My vertical frame is too wide, so I scoot closer. Still too wide, I keep moving in, refocusing on the sapphire eye nearest the lens. Finally, the frame is about right. Now I can sense him sussing me out, using his acute hearing and smell to form a mental image of me. He cocks his head from one side to the other. I refocus on the moving eye but do not make any exposures. His range of facial expression is amazing. Sometimes his eyes open wide or roll upward as if possessed by a divine light. I begin to make a few exposures. I feel he can see me perfectly, but not with his eyes. I make more exposures, strained to keep up with his small movements. The depth of field is very shallow, so the slightest change in the angle of the boy's face or movement of his eyes requires a focus adjustment. I click off frame after frame, worrying that my focus might be a bit off, or that I haven't quite caught the moment right yet. I never know when to quit. Now there is no more sound and no one else left in the room but Jong and me, and it feels as if we have been here for hours trying to make this picture. There is nothing left but the shifting focus and moving eye and the silent clicking of the shutter and Jong somehow seeing me better than I see him. Polygamy. The first time we visit the family of Tuamua Vang, a pseudonym, there are 34 people living in his four-bedroom rental house. The coat rack in the entryway is full, but not with coats. Instead, some 24 gang hang from the rack or lean in the corners. The Hmong play these curved bamboo instruments at funerals to ward off bad spirits and guide the soul of the deceased back to its birthplace. Gang players stalk the bad spirits like minesweepers, crouching low and bending over their rhinoceros horn-shaped instruments. They prowl around near the body of the deceased in a slow, circular dance, blowing into long vertical mouthpieces and fingering holes in the bundled bamboo. They produce low, wheezing tones that have a strangely calming effect on the listener. Every now and then, they will suddenly whirl about and scurry off in hot pursuit of errant spirits. Tuamua Vang is a gang master. Nearly every weekend, he is booked to play at least one Hmong funeral. He also builds and sells the instruments and teaches others how to play them. These skills bring him a good cash income and a lot of respect in the local Hmong community. After only 5 months in Fresno, the Vang family is relatively prosperous compared to other new arrivals. Most of the young adults in the household already have jobs despite speaking almost no English. But the most unusual thing about Tuamua is that he has two wives living together in the same house. Normally, the State Department breaks up polygamous Hmong families, consigning each wife and her children to different residences. But somehow, this family has managed to fly under the radar, and they all live together under one roof with their many children and grandchildren. Fascinated by this family and encouraged by their openness, I return again and again to photograph them. Sometimes I'm overwhelmed by their sheer numbers. There always seem to be people everywhere, coming and going from bedrooms and hallways, sitting together in little groups here and there on the living room floor, but never staying in one place for more than a few minutes. Kids play everywhere, and the doors are constantly banging at both ends of the house. Hmong videos run nonstop on a flickering television that nobody in particular watches. Somebody is always cooking up a huge pot of rice in the kitchen, while others chop vegetables or hack away at freshly butchered meat. Outside, Tuamua and his uncles carve mouthpieces for their gang in a shed next to the chicken coop. Young boys play an ancient Hmong game with small stones in the middle of the driveway behind Tuamua's second-hand SUV. I follow the Vang family for several months. Ka, the pregnant second wife, gets a little bigger every time I see her. During Hmong New Year, I photograph her getting into her costume with some difficulty in front of a tall plate glass mirror that leans against one wall of the bedroom. She keeps having to let out the skirt and adjust the silver coins to accommodate her expanding girth. One afternoon the following spring, just a couple of weeks before Ka is due to give birth, Tutu and I drop by for an impromptu visit after calling first. The day is unseasonably hot, and Ka is lying on the couch wearing only a bra and a loose-fitting skirt. She doesn't seem to mind our seeing her that way and talks with us for several minutes before getting up and putting on a blouse. The huge white orb of her pregnant belly is an amazing sight, like a planet with canals of translucent blue veins and deserts of scar tissue from her previous seven births. No one else is home except for a couple of younger children and a stepdaughter, who is sleeping in the other room. I have never seen this house so quiet. Ka cuts up a pineapple and serves it to us. There isn't much to photograph, so we just sit and talk. Ka and Tutu chatter away in Thai, a second language for both of them. Both women were born in Laos and are about the same age, yet the only language they have in common is the one they both learned in Thai refugee camps. As the conversation continues, Tutu becomes more animated. I detect a mischievous gleam in her eye as she glances in my direction. I just ask her how they make love when they are two wife, Tutu whispers. She said that they take turns. Tutu has what Dale Carnegie would have described as a winning personality. With her gregarious charm, she quickly makes friends and gains their confidence. She is fearless when it comes to asking questions. Thus, I am not surprised when Ka opens up and tells us all about her polygamous marriages, past and present. As the conversation continues, Tutu gives me periodic updates in English. I ask her what she does when it's not her turn. She said that she just lie there and pretend to be asleep. That afternoon, we learned that harmony in a polygamous Hmong family is determined by fairness. If one wife gets to go on a trip with her husband, the other one gets to go next time, Ka explains. The same goes for the bedroom. Each wife has her turn on certain nights, and the schedule must not change for any reason. My first husband had three wives, but he treated all of us very badly. He often cheated with other women and would disappear for weeks at a time, so I left him. Ka's impromptu discourse continues. When a Hmong man has several wives, they usually sleep in different partitions of a bamboo house. Each night he stays with a different wife. If the wife whose turn it happens to be is mad at him, then he has to spend the night by himself and may not sleep with another wife. Hmong men who do not treat their wives equally usually end up with broken families, opines Ka. Tua Mua is a good husband, she confides. He is always fair to both of us, and our household is a happy one. Tua Mua and his two wives have always shown great tenderness and respect for one another in my presence. I have made portraits of the three of them together on several occasions. On one visit, I watched the older wife, Mai, helping Tua Mua get ready for a funeral. She winds the long sash around his waist and ties it in front, then helps him on with his vest. She fusses over every detail of his clothing, straightening his collar and smoothing imaginary wrinkles from his white shirt and black silk harem pants. Finally, she helps carry his 5 or 6 gang out to the car. She is a good wife, observes a very pregnant Ka, resting on the couch. When Kavu's baby finally arrives, Tutu and I are invited to the soul-calling ceremony. There is no shaman at this ceremony. The extended family simply gathers to bless the new baby and eat together. But first, everyone ties white cotton strings around the mother's and baby's wrists, offering a verbal blessing with each one. Typical blessings include things like living a long life, having lots of children, and making lots of money. Three folding tables are placed end to end, covered in white cloth and laden with food. Special ceremonial foods are placed in the center, boiled whole chickens with lit candles protruding from their body cavities, a bowl of eggs each representing the soul, and a tall, multi-tiered party tray heaped with fruit, eggs, potato chips, Snickers bars, M&Ms, and dollar bills. All blessings for the mother and her newborn. Relatives are expected to leave larger cash gifts in white envelopes around the party tray. Meanwhile, on the enclosed back porch of the house, a young mother with a newborn infant about the same age as Ka's baby goes largely ignored by the celebrants. She is Ju Cha, the wife of Tuamua's oldest son, Chong. Her baby was born prematurely, and now, at 1 month, still weighs less than 5 pounds. The baby cannot eat normally and must be fed a liquid diet through a slender plastic tube implanted in her nose. Instead of a soul-calling ceremony like the one Ka's baby is having today, a shaman was called to perform a more serious ceremony for the baby shortly after she came home from the hospital. I had photographed Ju Cha many times in the months leading up to the birth of her second child. The 19-year-old mother also has a 3-year-old son. Ju caught my photographer's eye the first time I met the family. I could not help but make a connection between her story and that of Dorothea Lange's migrant mother, immortalized by the late photographer in a Central Valley farm labor camp during the 1930s. Lange's gritty black-and-white portrait of the woman and her 2 bedraggled children has come to symbolize the Great Depression in the American mind's eye. Ju would become my migrant mother in dozens of photographs as I followed the story of her family's resettlement in Fresno. 3 weeks after the soul-calling ceremony, Ju Cha's baby is near death and must be rushed to Children's Hospital. A feeding tube is inserted in her stomach, and she must remain in the intensive care unit for an indefinite time. Ju never leaves her side. Dudu calls me with the news and encourages me to go visit them. Unfortunately, she cannot accompany me. Her superior job performance has earned her a promotion, and she now works in the office as an employment counselor. I have just lost my best translator. The drive to Children's Hospital of Central California is a surreal experience. Perched on the desolate bluffs of the San Joaquin River, the giant pastel-colored structure looms on the horizon like an unfinished movie set. In a backroom deal with a developer who donated the land, the hospital's board voted to vacate its original facility in central Fresno and rebuild on this isolated site a county away. Here the developer hopes to sprawl a new city of red tile roofs and strip malls, in spite of the fact that there is no water. However, he didn't count on the fact that it is harder for an outsider to buy Madera County supervisors' votes than it is for a well-connected local. So the shiny new facility now languishes on the parched bluffs like a beached whale. Meanwhile, the hospital's mostly indigent patients, many of whom depend upon public transportation, must now find a way to make the 10-mile journey north, crossing the river via a congested 2-lane bridge. I follow a long hallway to the intensive care unit, where I am escorted to a small room. Ju Cha stands wearily over her baby. Tubes and wires seem to emanate from every part of the sleeping infant's body. Assorted monitoring devices beep, flash, and hum in arrhythmic synchronicity. Tuamua's older wife, Mai, has organized a highly efficient support system to deliver freshly cooked food, changes of clothes, and anything else Ju needs around the clock. Ju's husband comes every evening after work, but her 3-year-old boy is not allowed in the ICU due to the risk of infection. Ju occasionally sleeps for an hour or so on a recliner chair next to the baby's gurney. The image of 19-year-old Ju standing over her baby, surrounded by all of the postmodern wires, tubes, bandages, and electronic monitoring devices, is a photograph begging to be made. She is a 21st-century Madonna. Even the angle at which she holds her head while gazing at the baby and the way that her hair frames her delicate face evokes Titian, Raphael, Da Vinci. More importantly, this single image captures the essence of Ju's story, her incredible devotion to motherhood, and her long journey between 2 worlds separated by 8,000 miles and 200 years. Even the lighting is perfect. Subdued overhead spots throw a halo of soft, ethereal light over Ju and the baby, leaving the background in near darkness. After using up most of my Hmong vocabulary with greetings and pleasantries, I search the hallways until I find a Hmong nurse who can translate for me. I ask the nurse to ask Ju if I can take the photograph. With a very respectful Lao-style note, Ju thanks me for offering but says she prefers that I wait until the baby is better. Over the past 4 months, we have made countless photographs together, and this is the first time she has ever turned me down. I ask the nurse to tell Ju that this picture is very important. It will show everyone what a devoted mother she is, and it will also tell the story of her people and their long journey to America. However, Ju remains polite but firm in her resolve not to do the photograph today. If only Tutu were here. The nurse goes back to work, and I sit with Ju and the baby in silence. Mentally, I calculate the aperture, shutter speed, and focal distance I will need to make the photograph. Without lifting the camera to my eye, I study the scene and note precisely where the corners of the frame will go. If I am careful, one quick exposure is all I will need. Only a single click of the shutter to atone for. Maybe she won't even hear it amongst all of the whirring, humming, and beeping machinery, I rationalize. I flash back to the time a Hmong family invited me to photograph the funeral of their revered clan leader, Neng Tao Li. News of his death came as a shock to everyone in the family. He had appeared to be in perfect health. I was invited to take photographs and given a badge to wear that said, in Hmong language, family member. But there was one unusual stipulation. I was not to photograph the body under any circumstances. In the dozen or so Hmong funerals I had previously photographed, I had never faced this prohibition. The funeral was a large one. Relatives came from all over the country, and General Vang Pao made an appearance with his usual entourage of 6 bodyguards dressed like Secret Service men in suits and dark glasses. The moment arrived when all of the family members gathered around the body and began to weep. The hall was suddenly filled with a loud cacophony of intense wailing, moaning, and sobbing. This happens at every Hmong funeral and can last up to 45 minutes. No one signals this event. Everyone just seems to know when it is time. Just before the weeping started, I had positioned myself close to the body so that I could photograph the shaman seated nearby. He chanted continuously into a wireless microphone, performing the traditional Hmong funeral ceremony at a small table. A candle and a short stick of bamboo were his primary accoutrements, but 2 shot glasses of Bud Light had also been placed on the table as offerings for the soul of the departed. Occasionally, the shaman downed the shots himself and refilled the glasses from a pop-top can. While photographing the shaman, I would occasionally swing my wide-angle lens sharply to the left and grab a quick shot of the mourners surrounding their fallen clan leader. He was laid out in a gorgeous black and purple embroidered robe befitting his status. Hua Neng, as he was respectfully called by everyone in the family, had played a vital role in his community. He had mediated disputes and served as counselor, psychologist, and father figure to several hundred members of his extended family. In an op-ed piece for the Fresno Bee, our project anthropologist, Hank Delcor, described the late clan leader's importance. At all hours of the day and night, Hua Neng responded to calls from clanmates who faced some of life's most intractable problems. Parents who had lost control of their children, married couples on the verge of divorce, accusations of domestic abuse. In one case, he was called to a home where a man was pointing a gun at his own head. While other members of his clan and community slept, Hua Neng was often up at the wee hours of the morning because some situations do not wait for daylight. He was known as a man who was unfailingly rational and calm. When others acted rashly, he responded with reason, fairness, and the wisdom that comes with age and experience. The passing of Hua Neng was too important an event to be left out of the historical archive in which these photographs would eventually reside. without the image of the clan leader himself, surrounded by his many mourners, the story of his contribution to the community would never be complete for future generations of Hmong who will visit the online archive to learn about their history. Weighing these considerations against the admonition not to photograph the body, I decided that taking the photograph was the right thing to do. 2 weeks later, I mailed a CD of the images to Pang Li, Hla Neng's eldest daughter in North Carolina. I was surprised when her handwritten note card arrived at my office in less than a week's time. "My family and I thank you for your beautiful pictures. I have not taken a photo with my father since I was a young girl, so the photo of me standing close to him is priceless. Don't ever take your own father for granted like I did. One day he will be gone and you will regret everything you did not do for him. Now at least I have this photo to remember him." My gamble had paid off. I made another CD of the pictures for the Fresno clan members, and they were very happy to receive them. No one even seemed to remember that I had been told not to photograph the body. But today at the hospital is different. The camera is ready, the light is perfect, but I do not take the picture. The camera feels heavy around my neck. I feel the weight of the room, of the entire building. I look at Ju, the perfect Madonna. She is my migrant mother, the Hmong equivalent of the one Dorothea Lange photographed some 70 years ago, less than an hour's drive from this hospital. Here is the defining image of the last Hmong resettlement, yet I am incapable of recording it. Ju smiles at me, the same smile I remember seeing one day when I happened to run into her coming out of an ESL class clutching the first photographs I ever gave her. She speaks softly to me in Hmong, going on at some length. I listen hard but cannot understand more than an occasional word. I think she might be trying to tell me why she doesn't want to do the photograph. Perhaps she is afraid that it might disturb the spirits and somehow jeopardize the baby's chances of recovery. Not knowing enough Hmong to reply, I just smile awkwardly at her. She smiles at me again with that same radiant smile and looks at me for a long time. I stay a little while longer, then get up to leave. "Xin Chi Dua," she says as I walk out the door. "See you again." After 2 more months of confinement in this small room, Ju Cha and her baby girl will finally go home.
Friends, you've just heard from Joel Pickford reading selections from an outstanding book of prose and absolutely stunning photography that he has recently published entitled Soul Calling, A Photographic Journey Through the Hmong Diaspora. And although the book presents the reader with fine descriptions and many wonderful photographs of Laos, tonight's presentation focused mainly on that part of the book which describes the Hmong community of Central California. First, we met Tut Tu, who turned out to be Joel's driver, translator, and a person who knows the Hmong community so well that she was able to help her author meet, photograph, and question many of the people we heard about. Many in our Hmong community have similar backgrounds to Tut Tu's, which means that at the close of the Vietnam War, they were arrested and sent to a series of forced labor camps in Laos and Vietnam, where they spent as many as 10 years, but luckily were able to escape to refugee camps in Thailand. We heard about a family of 9, where 3 of the children are blind. We also heard that although normally our State Department breaks up polygamous Hmong families, there is still at least one family that the author met with one husband and two wives. We heard about the funeral of Law Ning, who was a kind of hero in his community because, for many years, at all hours of the day or night, he would always respond to calls for help from his fellow Hmong, parents who couldn't control their children, married couples who were about to divorce, domestic abuse issues, and threats of suicide. And finally, we heard about Yu Cha, whose baby was born desperately ill and who stayed with her baby at Valley Children's Hospital for several months. So what we really heard tonight was an eye-opening introduction to the Hmong community of Central California, its history, present conditions, and future prospects. Friends, our author tonight, Joel Pickford, is an award-winning photographer, filmmaker, and author. His works can be seen in many major museums. His films have been broadcast on PBS, and he's received grants from the California Council for the Humanities and the James Irvine Foundation to document the Hmong refugee culture of Central California. And the resulting book entitled Soul Calling, published by Heyday Press, is truly a masterpiece of research and photography, and we certainly recommend it. We thank Joel for his contribution to our show and hope we hear more from him on future programs. And so we come to the close of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our writer reader will be Craig Bernthal. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story. Until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.